Has a Purpose. Thanks so much for joining us this week. We have another really exciting guest that we can't wait to share her story with all of you. And before we get started with her interview, I thought it would be fun to talk about how we got to know her. And she's one of Alan's current students at Cambridge. So Alan, how did you get connected with our guest from today?
So I met Brianna in class, and she wanted to talk to me about some of the course material. And in the process of talking to her about the course material, we meandered into her backstory, which I found really, really interesting. We spent at least 75% of the time just talking about her background, and I knew she had to be part of the podcast.
Yeah, we're going to talk more about the project that she started in the interview here, but it's something that really resonated with our team, and the work that she's doing seems to really integrate well with this goal that both of our groups have of making sure that students and young people have access to great careers and things that they care about through, in her case, education and microfunding. We're really excited to talk with her and to get into this interview. So without further ado, let's talk with Brianna. This week, we are welcoming Brianna Goodlin. Brianna is currently a Master's of Business Administration student at the University of Cambridge Judge Business School. She is the founder and CEO of InvestEd, a startup company designed to facilitate micro support for financial and food insecure undergraduate college students, and which is inspired by her own journey grappling with homelessness and financial insecurity. She holds a Bachelor of Arts degree in social studies with an emphasis on ethnic conflict from Harvard University, and has considerable experience as a consultant to several companies and agencies about diversity, equity, and inclusion, anti-Semitism, and business innovation and growth. Brianna, welcome to Paths to Purpose, and thank you so much for joining us this week.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
We're so excited to hear your story. I think we would kind of love to start with your background before you went to Harvard and Cambridge. And could you tell us a bit more about your path prior to attending these two really elite institutions?
So I'll give the Cliff Notes version, because obviously there's a lot of places I could go into detail. But I was raised by a single mother who was sick basically my whole life growing up. She'd spend 3 to 6 months of every year in the hospital, numerous cancers, tumors, blood clots, MRSA. That was kind of the life. So in addition to growing up in poverty, I was also growing up with a single mother who was just trying to survive and live. And that was kind of the context. So I started working when I was 14 years old, and I've really been working ever since. And growing up, you know, living in poverty, it was the type of thing that everything from hunger to housing insecurity. When I was 14 years old, that's when we were homeless for a period of a few months, in addition to my mom being in the hospital at the same time. And I think what brought me to Harvard really was, from a very young age, I had this sense that like my only chance at escape was through education. So there was just this sense that like that was going to be my only way out. I remember when I was young, I was basically like, I want to go to these universities. And being in Tennessee, I wouldn't say there was the most robust systems to get someone into the Ivy League. So as a sophomore, I went to my counselor and was like, this is what I need from you. This is, you know, what I'm trying to do. And kind of for the next few years, I was the one guiding it. I would say that's the very Cliff Notes version of how I got there.
How did you get to that place yourself of figuring out that education was the way out that you wanted to take to change your life in that way? And that's a very heavy burden, I think, to have on yourself at such a young age when you have, you know, a mother who is sick and you're living in poverty. And how did you find, I guess, the strength, but also just the perseverance to figure out all of these obstacles to get you out of Tennessee?
Yeah, I would say that for me, one of the things that I'm just driven by curiosity. Anybody that has any conversation with me for an extended period of time, I'll probably mention some random study or thing that I've been reading. And so education was always my escape, especially when I was younger. And I think there was the turning point when I realized that it wasn't just an escape from my day-to-day life, but it could actually be a path to even more and all the things that I wanted to do and everything from there. And I think that, you know, resilience is really one of those words that means a lot to me, but it's a little bit difficult because it never felt like a choice. It's not like I was ever like, I'm going to push forward. It was like, how do I make this happen? And I think that's the mindset that's helped me in innovation, in everything that I've done, is it's never about, do we go forward? It's about how. And it's always just asking that question of like, where do I go from here? And I think that when you live the way that we did, you know, we lived in like a different place every year for like 8 years. There's just constant change. You know, it's never about, you never have stability. So you're just trying to figure out like, how do I get to that next point? And what was really transformational for me was being able to teach myself how to balance that short-term thinking with bringing in some long-term thinking. And I think that's really what brought me to Harvard and beyond, was that, you know, when you're living in poverty, you're living day to day, right? Like every day you're just trying to survive, and it's being able to create enough space mentally and emotionally to think longer term and plant a few seeds that you can then follow up on, that I think is what can make that difference in trying to actually push beyond getting trapped in that day-to-day cycle.
So Brianna, thanks for joining us. I love your story. It's incredibly inspiring. What I hear is a lot of independence and a lot of self-reliance. I'm curious to hear more about how you reached out for support from other people. How did you find trust? Because I imagine the environment you were living in, it's very difficult to earn trust because you're so vulnerable. So how did you source mentors? How did you source support?
I've had a really big journey, actually, when it comes to asking for help and trust and all of that. I think when I was little and younger, I very much, you know, was dependent on those around me. We survived off food baskets from churches. I had people buy my plane ticket to college. You know, I wouldn't have gotten to college if someone had not bought my ticket. I had people pay for my SATs and my applications. And I truly was a product of the people around me and of their generosity. And I think that in some ways, that's kind of where I'm at now with Invested and trying to create that for others. But I also went through a journey of not knowing how to ask for help. So once I'd gotten to Harvard, I very much struggled with this idea that now I've made it. I've gotten all this help. Like, they got me here, and now it's my responsibility to push forward. And so I went through years, you know, I really struggled in undergrad because I struggled to ask for help. I struggled to be able to accept even the help that was there. A book that I'll always plug is called The Privileged Poor by Anthony Jack, and it looks at the lives of poor students on elite campuses. And I was actually interviewed in it. And one of his chapters is a study on mental health and on how students ask for help even when there are resources. So I think it's been a journey of learning how to get back to that place of being able to accept help and realizing that you're never too old and you're never too established to be able to. And so early in my life, you know, I very much benefited from it. I got to the point where I thought, okay, now it's my turn to give back. I should be the one giving help, not getting it. And I kind of had to relearn the idea that, like, it's never one or the other. You can always be asking for help and giving it. And if you're only doing one, you're losing out in some way.
Do you know, or did you go through a process by which you would sort of funnel whose advice you would actually pay attention to and whose advice wasn't helpful for you? Because that's a theme in the career counseling that I go through, is that some people are trying to give advice with good intention, but it doesn't fit the narrative for you. So how did you process kind of who was helping you? And how you could trust them.
I think one of it is that trust of, like, you know, do I trust this person to have my best interests at heart and all of that? Do they understand the context of my life in which they're giving it? And so I think it's always taking a grain of sand. You know, you can always accept advice, but that doesn't mean you have to follow it. You know, you can accept advice from anybody, but evaluating, does this actually make sense? I think we get caught up in who's giving us advice that we don't focus on the actual advice, and being able to kind of separate and actually look at, like, what are they saying? Does this make sense to me? Where would this take me? I've been in therapy for many, many years, which I think everyone should do. And, you know, one of the things that I used to do is I would catastrophize and take things to the absolute worst conclusion, which in that case is negative, but it also gives me the ability to think through things and think through that path. And so if you can do it in a way that's not catastrophizing, but you can kind of think through the logical of, like, if I followed this advice, where would it take me? Where would I land? And is that a place I want to be? And work backwards, I think that can help you. So separating a little bit of who's giving you the advice with what the advice actually is, and pressure testing it before following it, I think can help figure out if this is something you want to go for. As well as remembering that, like, nothing's ever final. You can follow advice and realize that it's not great and go and get more advice or change your path. Just because you've started following someone's advice doesn't mean you have to keep following it. And I think we get so stuck in this idea that once we're on a path, there are no other options. And so I think it's always being willing to, like, reevaluate and question yourself. Have my motivations changed? Have my, you know, goals changed? In that case, maybe the advice should change as well.
I think that's so true. And especially thinking back to even my own time in college and those early phases of being at a higher education institution, and especially when you have to do things like pick a major and decide who you want to be in 10 years based on this one degree, is what it feels like, and feeling overwhelmed, and that once you've chosen something, you have to anchor yourself to it and you really have to stick with it, even if you feel later that it's not resonant with who you are as a person. So I think that's another question that I have for you is, how did you decide, once you got to Harvard and once you had been integrated into this institution, how did you decide that and who you wanted to be in the career that you wanted to have?
So the funny thing is, I've been having that breakdown like every few years for my whole life. I think the one that
I'm not alone.
the one that stands out to me the most actually is, I was in eighth grade, and this is right before high school, and we had to take like a career aptitude test where like it gives us like a recommended career, and there's like a circle with all these different paths, and in the middle was where I landed. So like I didn't even get like a rec, and I had a meltdown. They had to like send me home from school because I was melting down because I was like, if I don't know what I want to do, I'm not going to take the right classes in high school. And so I'm not going to get the right grades, and I won't get into the right college. If I don't get into the right college, how will I get the right career? It was this catastrophizing. And again, in college, you know, it's this like, if I don't choose the right major, I'm not going to, you know, choose the, you know, all of this. And I think that this is where I benefited from being at an institution like Harvard that provided the security and stability that I hadn't had previously, where I finally got to the point where I stopped trying to figure out like, where do I want to be and how do I get there? And I more figured out like, what excites me and what am I interested in? And I realized early on at Harvard, I met a guy who was going to work at Goldman Sachs, and he'd studied folklore and mythology. And it was kind of just this light bulb moment for me that like, it truly didn't matter what I studied. I was going to be getting skills and a degree that I could leverage basically anywhere. And so when I got to that point, I kind of realized, okay, so what am I interested? What am I excited about? Like, this is a chance to learn for the sake of learning and not learn for anything else. And so that's kind of what led me to study like genocide and ethnic conflict in the 20th century. I basically wanted to study the Holocaust. And, you know, I spent 4 years doing that. And then I went to work in innovation consulting, and they weren't directly connected because they didn't need to be. Being able to recognize the transferable skills you get in that and articulate that gives you the ability to do both. And we get so caught up in, you know, am I taking the right thing and it's going to lead to the right path, without recognizing that there are a lot of ways to get where you want to go. I applied to college undecided, and then I basically did the most undecided path you possibly could, because social studies is like the honors humanities that combines like six different fields. So like it includes history, government, psychology, sociology, anthropology, economics, and you can take classes in all of those, and then you create a focus field. So I basically did the undecided humanities major after applying undecided, because I really was like, here's this niche thing I'm really interested in. And my thesis was on rising Danish anti-Semitism, but it was four different chapters, each with a different lens on the same problem. And so I had like a psychological chapter and an anthropological chapter and a sociological chapter. And that's actually what I carried forward after Harvard, was I went into innovation and consulting, and it was all about looking at things from different perspectives and bringing the outside in and being able to critically think. And so the path from studying genocide to working in innovation, to me, actually feels quite linear because I took it. But if you're so focused on that, I need to have the exact qualifications, you're going to miss the chance to discover the things that excite you and finding out that there's so much more applicability in ways you wouldn't have imagined.
I wanted to think a little bit about the culture that you arrived in. So you were homeless in Tennessee with a very sick parent, and now you integrate into Harvard. And so many of us get a sense of our self-esteem by how people interact with us. And how was that for you? How did you handle that environment? Because it's a very big culture shock.
It's a huge culture shock. And I feel like I spent 4 years trying to catch up, and my peers spent 4 years getting further ahead. And so I wouldn't say it's something that I've necessarily mastered as much as I finally realized that I was never going to belong in the sense that I initially thought. And so I stopped trying to fit in, and I instead started trying to find spaces of belonging and creating them for myself, finding individuals or organizations or things that resonate with me, and creating this patchwork of things. Because when I got to Harvard, I didn't belong at home anymore, right? Like my family was still living with food insecurity. I would be at Harvard having all my food paid for and all of this. And I'd go home over winter break to like back to eating ramen and all the things that that meant and then come back to this. So, you know, I didn't belong in that world anymore, but I also never belonged in the world I existed in. I finally got to the point where I stopped trying to. And I would say that, you know, it's a balance. That's something that sounds easy to say, but like isn't actually. But it's that I stopped trying to belong as a whole. And I started realizing that like there are lots of different parts of me that belong in different places and to different people. And that together those can create a whole. And so finding individuals that I connected with as a low income student, finding individuals that I connected with due to a passion for education and all of that, I think crafted an identity and a space of belonging that didn't exist in the past and doesn't necessarily exist now because it requires a lot of effort, but it also requires a recognition that something as old and established as an institution like that, people from backgrounds that are never going to actually understand where you come from, there's only so much you can do and there to meet in the middle. And so you kind of have to start crafting and carving out your own spaces.
I think that that's such an important point and something that I think a lot of college students can probably relate to regardless of background is that feeling that when you go into college or just into a new space, whether that's, you know, a new location or a new job, and feeling like you really have to try to change who you are or something about you to fit in with those around you. And so I think that that's such an important and inspiring point that you make, that you don't have to change anything about you or your background or the person that you are to find community in a space. And I think this is kind of a great time to talk about your latest launch and InvestEd. I'd love to hear about the idea that you had in launching this company and why do you think that this work is so important, and tell us about where you think that you're headed.
So InvestEd is a platform where high-achieving, low-income students can create a profile, and then people can invest directly in them. And our focus really is on small-dollar recurring amounts. So $5 for a cup of coffee, $10 so you can work 1 hour less. We want to connect students with that everyday financial support that makes a difference. And on the investor side, you know, first of all, the investor language is very important to us because you're investing in their future, in their success, and getting a chance to be a part of it. You're also getting the benefit of transparency and impact. You could donate $20 to a large organization and hopefully feel good that they're using it, or you could give it directly to a student that you know you're buying them food or you're saving them work. And so that's what we try to do, is we try to connect people who want to give and who want to see the impact of what they're giving to students who need it and where that everyday support makes a difference. You know, $5 doesn't necessarily mean much to a lot of people. It's a cup of coffee, but to a low-income student, like that goes a very long way. We're very focused on the agency and the empowering aspect of it. So for students, like they know what they need. We allow them to create wish lists of items that they need for people to buy them directly. They get to set the levels, but ultimately we're giving them cash because at the end of the day, like, you know, you might need a cup of coffee to energize yourself, right? Like someone might give you money for books, but like what you might actually need is food. You might actually need gas for your car, and you should be able to choose how you spend it. And so that's a little bit of the genesis of it, and where it came from was really this idea that I think that there's a huge desire to give. I see that from the pandemic, from even like Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign, the idea that every dollar makes a difference. There's such a desire to give, and people want to see the impact of their giving. And for low-income students, we want to eventually expand to the idea of high potential low-income. So the students that if they didn't have to work, if they weren't hungry, they could achieve so much. And that little bit makes a difference. And we also want to create this connection between the investor and the student. You know, I am a product of those who invested in me. I would not be where I am without the people who at every opportunity found ways in small and big to support me. And I want to create that network for low-income students who don't usually have it. They don't have the cultural capital. They don't have this network to tap into. And so we're trying to build that so that they can take advantage of the opportunities. Even if you're a low-income student at Cambridge and you have a full bursary, if you miss the 1 hour the dining hall's open and you can't work, you might not have £5 to get a meal deal from Tesco. And so what do you do? So it's that level of dignity that is being provided to students where we're recognizing the potential they have and someone's, you know, desire to be a part of their their success. There's a level of impact that investors are getting by getting to truly see who they're giving to, have that connection. And so that's what we're trying to facilitate.
I wanted to ask a quick follow-up on that. I know that this is a podcast and people are hearing your voice, not seeing your face. But as we're recording this, seeing you light up and talk about this work that you're doing was just so incredible just now, just to see how important and connected you are to this company that you are building. So my follow-up to that is, did it feel scary to launch something like this on your own? And kind of, you know, I think that that's something that people look for a lot is stability and security. And so starting something from scratch can feel really intimidating. I'd imagine I've never started anything from scratch other than this podcast. So I'd love to hear about, you know, if it did feel scary, how did you work through that? And how are you building this and working through those emotions?
Yeah, I'd say there's two things. I think the first one is that as someone who grew up homeless, I understand the need for security and stability. When I graduated undergrad, I went into consulting. And because I was making a good paycheck, I've been able to provide my family with stability they never had. I was able to co-sign my mom's lease and pay for rent or insurance, or when, you know, a tire blows or something. My sister was out of work for a few months and I was able to supplement. Like, I was able to provide my family with stability they'd never had and prevent further disaster. And so I understand that. The majority of people listening to your podcast probably have so much more stability than they realize. And I think that's what's so important to me is that one of the application questions for Cambridge when I was applying for the MBA was, what's your greatest failure? And when I read this, you know, I kind of laughed because I was like, okay. And this was my response. I was like, for most people, like, their greatest failure is probably a startup failing or something. For me, failure was homelessness. Like, failure was hunger. I had a very different barometer for what it means to fail. And so I think if people can recognize the fact they have a safety net and they have a support system and all these things that make it a lot less scary to push the boundaries, I think that makes it a lot easier. Even for someone like me that doesn't have the safety net, I was able to finally recognize that I have skills and value. And if I need to, I can go get a job and all of that, even though I don't necessarily have the financial and familial stability and safety net that most people have. That doesn't mean I have nothing. There's always something to fall back on, whether it's friends, family, something along those lines. So feeling a little safer, I think, is really important. And the second thing is that it took me a while. My first conversation with one of my cohort mates was on October 7th. And in that time, we've gone from an idea in my head to building an MVP platform, entering competitions, create, you know, all of this has happened so quickly. But I also spent 3 to 4 years thinking about this. This is something that existed in my head for a really long time. And so it took a long time to get to that point where I felt ready to share it with others and I felt ready to actually pursue it. And the second I did, it took off. Part of me, I do think timing wise, I got really lucky. I have an amazing team from my that are all MBAs, and like there's so much kismet to like what's happening. But also, if I'd been talking about this earlier, if I brought that out, who knows what would have happened sooner. And so I think that's something too. If you have an idea, if there's something you want to pursue, just talking about it to others can find people who have similar passions, who have complementary skills, who can help bring this to light, because you don't need to do it on your own. Anything startup-wise, they talk about your founders and your team, and it can be a little bit lonely to think about doing something on your own, but you never actually have to. If you're talking to the people that love you, the people that care about you about these ideas, they will support you and be your team in some way or another. And I think knowing that, it makes it a lot less scary to push forward and take it in and make it real.
That's so important. And I think the similarities that I'm seeing between what you talked about and asking for help and building something and building this team now are super clear to me. And I'd love to connect that back to your target audience or your target demographic and these students. I'm thinking back to what you said earlier and how hard it was to kind of learn to ask for help, and particularly for the students that you're trying to reach. How do you make it easy for them to ask for help with InvestEd? And have you seen that that makes it easier for these students to lower those fears and can continue to ask for help in other ways outside of this financial insecurity?
Yeah, that, you know, one of our big things is trying to lower the barriers of entry for students to getting help. You know, instead of having to write an essay and pour your heart out and be the one chosen to then get some amount of money, it's creating something as simple as similar to a LinkedIn profile of, here's what I'm studying, here's who I am, and having that be enough for someone to provide money to you. And, you know, we've been doing interviews with low-income Harvard and Cambridge students, And one of the quotes that stands out to me is cash is freedom. That is something that matters. And so by focusing on that foundation and providing it, we give them the emotional and mental space to think about other things. So when you're not having to worry about where your next meal is coming from, you're not having to worry about all of the work you have to do to survive and afford these things, you can think about other things. And then it's easier to ask for help, to explore things, right? Like when you're not in survival mode, there's so much more mental and emotional space that you have that I think you can then use to take advantage of other things. And if there's someone that has shown you again and again that they're giving you $5 a month, $10 a month, right? There's a level of trust and stability being built up that it's a lot easier than to go and ask for advice or anything along those lines. And so that's the connection we're trying to build between student and investor is when you provide the financial foundation, you create trust that then allows them to take advantage of everything more that the investor has to give. Because we want to make it sort of, you know, can give so much more than money, but you have to start there. And I think that creates a relationship that can be built upon.
So, Brianna, this is really cool because I wanted to echo what you said with respect to one of the ways through the risk, fear of risk, is building the right team. And I actually happen to know your team and they're incredible. Like, genuinely, I know there some of them are going to listen. And I didn't get paid to say that about you guys. It also reminds me of one of my former students who's now building his third airline. And he basically, when we interviewed him about how he did it, he basically said, I built the team. So it's about organizing the team. But I'm looking behind you and I know people are listening and they can't see what's behind you. But what's behind you is a lot of notes and sticky notes on a board. And one of the other ways that people get overwhelmed by going their own path is it's chaotic. And particularly doing like a startup is sort of this chaos. How do you organize your brain around what to do because it's all chaotic?
When I have ADHD, so there's an extra level of chaos in my brain, which you can see in the board behind me. And so part of it is also, you know, if you have things like ADHD, I also have depression, like getting on medication that helps me manage it has been a years long thing that has changed my life. So that part of it as well is knowing like what help you need, whether it's medication, whether it's therapy or along those lines, that you know what strategies work for you. And I think that's what's helped me in so many ways is I know how to organize myself in a way that like doesn't try to fight against the way my brain works or these types of things. So I think that's first is just recognizing what helps and what doesn't when it comes to you. Does it help to have someone else that you can bounce ideas off of that can maybe capture them so you can just speak? And that's something one of my team members and I do is sometimes we'll just get together and I'll just go and I'll talk and she'll capture everything and then she'll bring some sense to it. Having someone you can do that with or being able, I think, just to take it one step at a time. And so this is where my innovation training comes in is that, you know, we work with companies on how to adopt startup methodologies. And a lot of it is helping them figure out, okay, so what's the MVP, right? What's the minimum we need to see if this works? And then what assumptions do we have? What are the things that we're assuming? And how can we test that? Who can we talk to? I've done a lot of design thinking. And so, you know, it's always about how can you be validating your assumptions? How can you be going and talking to people? And I think starting there, figuring out what do I need to learn? What do I know and what do I need to learn? And then building it from there. And I would say for me, what I do is I try to capture everything that happens in my head so I don't lose it, but then I can still narrow things down. So recognizing that like if you capture everything, you can still focus on one thing and you're not going to lose everything else. Because I think that's where the chaos can come from as well, is it's this idea that if you don't make sense of all the chaos, you're going to miss things or you're not going to be able to move it forward. Recognizing that like you can pull things out of chaos and solve them and then go back and it starts actually taking shape, and recognizing things that you're not going to be able to sort out and being able to create some emotional space from it and figuring out what you can. I think that's really been my whole life philosophy, is knowing that like there will always be things outside of my control. There will always be things that I can't fix. So what can I take control over? And what can I try to figure out? And I think being able to create distance between the things that you can't and focus on the things you can is very empowering. And that creates a very virtuous cycle for doing more and tackling bigger and harder problems. So also sometimes starting easy. One of the first things I did was I just started interviewing low-income Harvard students to hear about their experiences, because I wanted to be like, is this just me? Are there other people facing the things I did? And one of the interviews that I did, a quote was, the thing I remember most, the most memorable part of my Harvard experience is all the things I didn't get to do. And that broke my heart. Because if you're at Harvard, if you've worked so hard to get there as a low-income student, you should be able to take advantage of all those opportunities, because for you, they're even more life-changing, right? Everything you do there is life-changing in ways that for many others it isn't. And if they're not able to take full advantage of that, then we're doing them a disservice. We're just opening the door without actually creating a path to it.
I think I need to just save that clip of you and replay it when I start to feel overwhelmed and that I can't figure out what to do so that I can have some reassurance. I love everything that you just said. I wanted to talk quickly a bit more about mental health, and that's something that we've talked a lot about on this podcast. What are some of your strategies for staying healthy? And as you mentioned, and thank you for sharing your background with ADHD and depression, and how do you stay on top of making sure that mentally you are there to show up for your team or for yourself, for your friends, whoever it is, while you have a lot of things on your plate?
It's been a very long journey. And I will say, first of all, I think that like everyone should have a therapist. I think everyone in the world should be in therapy. That's a personal crusade of mine that I think everyone would benefit from. But part of that, and one of my big things that I tell others about, is build the bridge before you need it. I learned this from a partner at one of my last firms, and he was talking about relationships and BD. But for me, it actually really applies to mental health. By talking to a therapist, building a relationship with someone who understands you when you're not in crisis, by the time you're in crisis, they can actually help you. And so even if it's not therapy, whether it's medicine, family, recognizing crises that might happen, trying to recognize either tendencies you have or things that you do, and being able to get in front of them can make all the difference in the world, even just for dealing with it in the moment. So sometimes with my depression, I'll spiral. And so something that I do is I actually just preempt it with the people that I'm working with, is I let them know that, like, here's some tendencies that I have. Here's some warning signs. Like, some of my best friends, there's warning signs they have of like, okay, are you falling into a depression? Are you getting in this? And we've figured out over the years, like, things they can do that pull me out or that center and ground me. So recognizing what works and not being afraid to like enlist the people in your life that love you to help you manage those things can make all the difference in the world. As well as, like, for me, I just try to be very honest and vulnerable with my team and with the people that I'm in, partially because I don't think there's shame in this. I survived homelessness, all these things. Like, of course I'm depressed and have depression. Like, my life's been hard. Like, I have so many stories. Of course I have depression, and I'm still here and I'm still pushing. And like, that's the powerful part. I'm honest with people in every team, in every situation, one, to create opportunity for them to be honest and to be vulnerable, but also because it's a lot harder for someone to get mad at you for something if you've warned them in advance. And so it gives you a little bit of that like mental space as well, where, you know, it's not all going to fall apart if I fall apart. It's not all going to fall apart. And that gives you, I think, the ability to center and ground yourself. At this point, I'm probably all over the place with my strategies, but I think that it's been a many, many years of talking to therapists, getting on the right medication, being willing to like face my own issues and what are the triggers and what are the things that set me off and what are the boundaries that I need, whether it's personally or professionally. Just last week, I had like a 9 and 11 a.m. class and I needed the sleep. So I slept through the 9 a.m. and it was like a one big class with a break in between. So I showed up at the 11 a.m. and the professor tried to like shame me and was like, I didn't see you at the 9 a.m. And honestly, I was like, I needed the sleep. I know my body enough to know when to push it and when not to. I'm glad I'm here. Like, I'm glad I showed up for the 11 a.m. I'm not sad that I missed the 9 a.m. I'm glad I made it to this because I easily could have slept through it all. So giving yourself credit for the things that you do and not being so hard on yourself. I think it took me years to understand the idea of self-compassion, and I still struggle with it a little bit. But I think viewing these things that others would view as failures as wins, like, you slept through your 9 a.m. Yeah, but I made it to my 11 a.m. So you are welcome. I am here. And I've had those depths of depression where I didn't get out of bed. I couldn't make it to the 11 a.m. And so that's why I can recognize something even that small as growth and as progress.
That's like incredibly empowering. It's funny because there's this idea that mental health and discussing mental health is a weakness, but hearing you talk about it, there's so much strength coming out of you. And for the record, I was not the professor who shamed you for
That's he was not. He was a 2 p.m., so he never had to worry about it. I was always going to be awake by his class.
So briefly, as we're kind of wrapping up, what are you reading? I mean, besides my notes for class or whatever, what are you reading? What websites are you on? Where do you go? What podcast? Like, where's your brain going when you're just relaxing? What kind of things do you have for the audience where they might be interested in going?
A lot of places. My brain's kind of always in a lot of places. I think there's a balance of what you're looking for. So Vox is one of my favorite websites to learn about things. They do a great job with explanatory journalism. So I think it's fun just to see things I wouldn't have. When I need a brain break, I listen to Harry Potter. I fall asleep to it every night. So that's the calmer aspect of it. When I'm really looking for kind of engaging things, I have a whole list of books. One of the books I just finished reading is Culture Warlords. This is a woman who kind of went undercover in white supremacist communities online to examine them. And like, she wrote this book about it. I'm really big on Audible. So I listen to books through there because it allows me to do it while I'm reading or do it while I'm walking or, you know, or other things. I go through phases of different things that I want to learn about. Invisible Women is a little bit old, but it's really good as a book to see all the ways that gender bias shows up in our world. I mentioned The Privileged Poor earlier. I'd recommend that one just for understanding the lives of poor students on elite campuses. It talks about housing and food insecurity. I was interviewed for it, which is partly why I'm big on recommending it, is because I think it gives people a good idea of the experiences that I had. Anthony Jack, who wrote it, also did such a great job at figuring out what are actionable things that universities and others could do to provide further support. The Power is an older book by Naomi Alderman. That one's one of the few fiction books that I read. I read a lot of nonfiction, partially because I just think there's so many interesting things in the world. And I have a lot of websites that I actually have what's called Brianna's Reading Space in Slack, which is a channel that I just go post every single article that like I'm wanting to read or am reading, and I ended up having others join it from like my cohort. And so it's kind of just like a curated space of the different things that I'm reading. But I also read a lot of Wikipedia. Like I have limits on the Wikipedia I can read because I read a lot of Wikipedia, but I also donate to them monthly, so I feel okay about it.
I need to take notes on all the things that you just said. Like I'm going to go through this afterwards and go write all of these down. Thank you so much for joining us today and for so openly sharing your story and for being vulnerable with our audience. We really appreciate it. And it's just been such a pleasure to have you. Before we fully wrap, we wanted to ask you where people can find you, where they can find Invest Ed. You know, hopefully there might be a few people listening that might be really interested in what you have to offer for students. So would love to just give you the opportunity to share anything that you'd like our audience to be able to hear.
Yeah. So we just launched our landing page, www.be-invested.org. You can actually sign up to potentially partake in our pilot that we're launching at Harvard and Cambridge in the fall, as well as sign up to be an investor. So you can put your email in there. We're also on LinkedIn, although we haven't really put anything on it, and Instagram. But again, we haven't really done. We're there, and that's about it. But we'll get there. We'll get there. I can be found on LinkedIn as well. And the only thing I'll say, though, is that there's a lot of value in sending me multiple messages because I will forget to answer or I'll answer in my head. Then I'll be like waiting for the other person to answer. And it's because I only answered in my head. I didn't answer out loud. People can find me, Brianna Goodlin, on LinkedIn. And don't feel afraid to send me more than one message because that probably increases your likelihood of me answering because I have ADHD and I answer in my head and then I don't answer out loud. And I feel so bad all the time. So that's
awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us this week. We really appreciate your time. And everyone that's listening, thank you so much for listening.
Thanks for listening. This episode was made possible by our audio engineer, Jack Booth, and our growth strategist, Mikey Lulo. For more resources and inspiration on finding your purpose, check out our Instagram @PathsToPurposePod. We'll see you next time. Bye.